Good morning. Before we start, Paul White said he would order 12 books. I counted 9 people last week, and hopefully that'll catch anybody who wasn't here that doesn't have a book. Another preliminary remark. Jenny Dixon asked me this morning if metaphysics is what she sees in Borders' books, in the section entitled Metaphysics. And the answer is probably not. There is a class of what you might call literature going on by the title of metaphysics that is more like esoteric, New Age kind of medicine and that kind of thing. So this is philosophical metaphysics. That is kind of what sells, I guess. Last week, we covered very quickly the Christian worldview in terms of its metaphysics, in terms of its understanding of reality. We saw that the ultimate reality is God. There is nothing more fundamental than God himself. From him all being springs. He doesn't spring from anything. We saw that the world is two types of things, the material and the immaterial. We saw that the world was created good, that it fell in Adam, and it is to be redeemed. We saw that abstract entities have real, non-spatial, not in space, non-temporal, not in time, existence. We saw that man was created in the image of God, fallen, and some of them will be redeemed, are redeemed, will be redeemed by Christ. The purpose of this class is sort of to wrap up by comparing it to a few non-Christian worldviews. Well, name really two types of monism. At the end of this course, we'll think about a few other kinds of worldviews in a more apologetic sense. And this is more to cover their metaphysic, their view of reality. We'll be covering physicalism, or the specific kind of materialism that says everything boils down to that which does have spatial and temporal existence, that which is somewhere, you can measure it, you can feel it, it has mass, it has location. And we'll also be covering Hinduism as a representation of various Eastern types of thought. Buddhism came from Hinduism. Jainism is a kind of Hinduism. So covering Hinduism is a convenient way to cover several different kinds of Eastern monistic philosophies. First, before I continue, I'm not going to cover everything I want to cover, but please feel free to ask me questions. I am going to post my notes online. I tried to make them a little bit more in detail for this week. And so if you have questions about the notes when you're reading them later that I didn't cover in class, please feel free to ask me about them. So firstly, another view of reality is physicalism. We'll ask the same three questions that we asked last week. What is the ultimate reality? What is the nature of the world? And what is the nature of man? First, the ultimate reality. Obviously, physicalism is not a Christian worldview. From our understanding of Romans 1, it's fairly clear that their goal is to define the ultimate reality as in not the God of the Bible. Whatever they define it as, it's not the God of the Bible. There is no one understanding of ultimate reality in physicalism, except for some form of matter. What that form takes is up for debate, but really, as long as it's not God, most of them are pretty happy. You might hear people saying it's matter is the ultimate reality. That's true of physicalism. They might try to go further down and say matter is made up of atoms, which are made up of subatomic particles, which are made up of, some of them might say, strings. And what that means, it depends on who you ask, and you get a lot of interesting theories. Some people say energy is the ultimate reality, and that energy can have properties of that we see as matter. The interesting thing is there, in physical science, and we would agree with most of these things, there are four fundamental forces, what you might call, well, they're fundamental because people haven't explained them. Gravity is a fundamental force. The ability for one object that has mass to act on another object many, many miles away. And fundamentally, there is no explanation for it. They have theories. Graviton is this hypothetical particle that puts a gravitic force on something. Strong nuclear force is a force that's really low level and it holds a lot of things together. Weak nuclear force is something that's not so strong. It's still below the atomic level. And electromagnetism. A coworker of mine who is an atheist, physicalist, says that magnetism might as well be magic, as far as he's concerned, because we haven't explained it yet. So there are many unexplained aspects to the world's understanding of matter, how it fits together, and yet they're perfectly willing to take these on faith without being able to. They're able to experiment on them, and so in their arbitrarily set standards for scientific, I guess, empiricalism, the ability to, what you know is limited to what you can measure, then they're fine with that. Whereas if we say that miracles are possible, they're not fine with that. It's an arbitrary distinction. Now, I mentioned earlier strings, the so-called string theory, what some physicists call the theory of everything. This exemplifies a tendency towards reductionism on the part of materialists, of physicalists. Some try to go further and further down, but the idea is you can explain everything in terms of very simple things. So many years ago, people postulated that there was, I think, phlogiston, I don't remember what the name is, but instead of oxygen, there's this substance in the air called phlogiston. And it became understood as oxygen, which is a bunch of oxygen molecules, you know, high energy flying around in the air. Being able to explain all of matter in terms of atoms is a form of reductionism. We're fine with that. That's been experimentally shown. So reductionism isn't necessarily bad, but when they start taking it further down and down, saying gravity, strong nuclear force can be explained in terms of things smaller than atoms, and most of that is entirely on faith. You start exposing some of these fundamental commitments that the physicalists have to their worldview without allowing for God. You might hear of Occam's razor in debates with evolutionists. William of Occam was a fellow who said, if there are multiple sets of explanations for a phenomenon, you should take the one with the fewest required pieces. So if the one example is if a tree caught on fire up above, you could say lightning struck it, or you could say someone drove a tractor up to the tree, put a ladder up to it, lit the top of the tree, went down, and then covered up his tracks. There are more explanations to that particular argument, and so you should take the simpler one. This, of course, requires that you have some fundamental assumptions about how things are. If you assume that God doesn't exist, then obviously any explanation that has God in it will be more complicated, and therefore you should not choose it. So it's sort of a circular kind of way of thinking. This is a form of methodological reductionism, trying to reduce the way you think about something to a smaller number of steps. So this whole tendency towards reductionism belies a commitment to not God, you might say. So that is their ultimate reality, is matter. Matter or energy or strings, whatever it is that which has spatial or intemporal existence. The view of the world is that it's made up of matter. It's not really more complicated than that. That their ultimate reality feeds into their view of the world. Now, obviously, there are abstract entities, what we would call abstract entities, things like properties, maleness, redness, goodness, things like numbers, 1, 2, 3, propositions. If I don't finish this class soon, the class will be asleep. This statement is intended to have some sort of truth value. You say it's true or false, hopefully false. There are sets, conceptual groupings of things, the set of all women in the world, the set of all letters in the English alphabet, the set itself, not the items in the set, which are called members of the set, but the set itself is an abstract entity. Relations, if something is bigger than something else, if something describes something else. These are all abstract entities, but the physicalist has already said all there is matter. And so they have to find some way to explain that what we would consider abstract, what we would consider that doesn't have spatial existence, doesn't have temporal existence, is actually physical. A few of the positions taken, and this is to compare with the somewhat easier job we have to explain abstract entities. We say redness is a universal. There is a universal property called redness, and it describes many things. It relates to many things. Yes, Jeff.
The physicalists would probably break down the abstract principle as being molecules interacting in the brain, and then go down to those molecules and see how they interact.
Right.
And that would produce the abstraction.
Mm-hmm. But the one of the questions you ask is, how can something be qualitatively similar to something else? If I'm going to steal an example from a book, but I'm going to choose a different color. Let's pretend these two are exactly the same size, exactly the same filled in. Let's pretend they're perfect circles. They're not, but anyway. They're both blue. How if this particular example of a blue dot has blueness, how can it be similar to this? If we say there is a universal property called blue, we can say both of these have the property of blue. If the physicalist says blueness exists in my mind, well, how is it that this blueness is similar to this blueness? And that's what we'll sort of cover right now. It's a hard problem for the physicalist, which goes to show that they go to great lengths to suppress the knowledge of God. One school of thought is called extreme nominalism, and this is the one that you sort of cock your head at, but they say properties do not exist. Blueness does not exist. The only things that exist are these two little dots and the words that I use in my mind to describe them. So what exists is this actual thing, particles of ink on a whiteboard in a certain configuration, and blue in my mind. Blue is a convenient tag that I use to describe this. And when I say blue to you, it happens to correspond with other things that you have called blue in the past. So this is their way of saying that blue only exists in the minds of every person that perceives something. It's extreme. It's extreme nominalism. They say properties do not exist. Then you can go down to nominalism, which is a little bit more reasonable. Properties are that which is brought to mind by excluding other things. Look at this blue dot. If I ignore its circle shape, if I ignore how high it is off the ground, if I ignore all these things and I only focus on one aspect of it, that is its color, that is its property. It still exists only in my mind. They would say that blueness is the set of all things, set, abstract entity, we'll not get into that, is the set of all things that are blue in the world. It's the set of all blueness properties that apply to blue. So let's say you have a blue number 1. 2. If I take this one, the blue 3 that applies to this, the blue 4 that applies to this, all of them in the world, that is blueness. So obviously it's somewhat difficult to understand because they're really just trying to formulate ways to explain away any type of abstract universal that exists apart from matter. And I have to admit, it's very hard to understand, so I probably haven't done the best job explaining it, but the point of my explaining it in this way is to show you that there are attempts to try to place what we call abstract entities in the physical mind of a person. This is all opposed to realism. Properties are universal. There is blueness that exists by itself. That's what we believe. We believe that blueness exists. We are realists. There are other realists who are not Christians, but what we are is realism. I'm going to go a little different tack here and talk about mathematics. We would view mathematics as being part of reality, and so it falls under the study of metaphysics. If you do not believe that there are absolute universal truths apart from physical minds, then what does this mean? It's 1 plus 2 is 3, right? It's always 3. It's never 4. It's never, unless some people say for large values of 1, but sorry, math joke. The 1 plus 2 is a combination of abstract entities using an abstract relation called addition. You add them together and it relates it to the number 3, which is also an abstract entity. 3 exists whether humans exist or not, but the physicalist has to say that mathematics is a construction of human thought. There was no use. I mentioned the counting dinosaurs last week. If there's one dinosaur before there's people, if there's one dinosaur sitting on a hill and another dinosaur walks up, how many dinosaurs are there? The answer is, doesn't matter. There are no people to count them. It's sort of the tree falls in the forest kind of a silly way of thinking, I guess. In mathematics, there are many mathematicians who are realists, mathematical realists. We are mathematical realists. We say one has real universal value, importance. There's a movement fairly recently called mathematical constructionism, which says mathematics is not discovery. Mathematics is invention. When you describe a theorem, such as, we don't need to worry about that. But if you describe some sort of mathematical theorem, it is neither true nor false until it has been proven either way. We would say, in logic, there is a law called the law of excluded middle. If you have a proposition, if I don't finish soon, this class will be asleep, then it is either true or false. It can't be both, it can't be neither. Constructionists say it can be neither. It is unproven. It is neither true nor false. One of the sad things as a mathematician is you just throw out 80% of the history of mathematics. As a mathematical constructionist, you cannot use induction. You cannot say, because this and this, therefore this. You can't extrapolate a theory, an idea. There are very, very many theorems in mathematics that have been proven using induction. And by committing themselves to constructionism, they say, well, we just haven't proven these yet. And yet many of these things have been taken for granted for years and years. So they're sort of trying to say, well, let's be consistent physicalists. Let's go back and redo mathematics. And what they're finding is they can't. So that's their view of the world. Their view of man, it's just another animal. We discussed very in passing the idea of emergence. Emergence meaning if you have a set of things, each one of these things has a property, but it does not have the, let's pretend these are individual points. They have no dimension. They just have a location. When you take a system of these things, it starts to take on the characteristics of another pattern. An anthill being comprised of a bunch of simple-minded, or not simple, nervous system ants that interact with a certain set of rules. And when you get that set of rules, then all of a sudden you have this complicated structure called an ant colony. They would use this to explain life. Life is a complex pattern arising out of complex matter. Intelligence is a complex pattern arising out of complex life. And some of them would go so far as to say that God is a complex pattern arising out of complex intelligence. Now, emergence is a convenient way to explain away the relationships between simpler and more complex things, and there are many problems with it. But this just to say that this is one way they try to explain the intelligence of man. Scott mentioned last week in our discussion the notion of determinism. Man, really, to a physicalist, cannot have a will, because ultimately there is nothing but matter. And if your mind is really entirely existing in your head, in your brain, then it really is simply physical, caused by physical events, which are caused by physical events, which are caused by physical events, which have no will of their own. So you can't really say that there is that I have a will. You can only say that what I am doing is the result of a chain of physical reactions. This is what we would call hard determinism. In my view, the only position available to a physicalist. There are many physicalists who hate that idea, and they, as Scott said, you get into this idea of a soul. You get people trying to believe in emergence. So it's a very interesting study. Sometimes amusing, sometimes just sort of surprising. You wonder, this is an amazing length to which they will go to avoid explaining things in terms of God or the supernatural. So that, in short, is physicalism. The other school of thought that I wanted to cover is Hinduism. The ultimate reality for Hinduism is Brahman. Everything is Brahman. He is sort of the divine spark throughout the universe. And anybody that says otherwise is lying. Everything is one. Everything is Brahman. And that's it. Matter is an illusion. Matter is a result of the truth being hidden from man. They don't believe that the truth has been lost, just hidden. Everybody still has a spark of Brahman in them, and that's what gives them consciousness. But everything, their view of the world is that everything around us is illusion. That's not there, really. I am the fact that, well, it sort of hurts your head, actually, to try to think of it. Greg Bahnsen does a very quick and good job refuting it, saying that if our goal, because they believe that the goal of man is to break out of this cycle of reincarnation, and the way you break out of this cycle is to fully understand, fully realize the fact that all is one. And he says, if all is illusion, then the fact that I'm not in, that I haven't broken from this cycle is also illusion. So there we go. I win. Shelley.
That's right. If all is illusion, then all is one. What?
Brahman. If that is your fundamental, then, you know, I can't claim to think that way. It's very hard.
Yeah. has like an irrationalistic flair to it. Because even illusion then would be part of, you know, they say illusion. It's just, it's irrational.
Right.
Illusion would have to be part of, or it wouldn't exist.
Right.
Then what is it? Yeah, it tends towards a kind of like a, it has loose ends that can't be connected.
Right, right. So, man is simply a being that is closer to this liberation, moksha they call it, than animals and plants are. Plants are also on the cycle. Anything that has life is on this cycle. Reincarnation is the process of getting closer or further away from this realization. Hindus follow the caste system. Man is born into what he is. And that, so there's no notion of real conversion. You are what you were born to be, and when you die, you'll get born to be something else, hopefully something better. If you are an untouchable, which is a caste that they don't even recognize in their religious writings, hopefully you will be in a valid caste later.
What determines that?
Who you were born to. Ultimately, as we know, ultimately somebody started and said, hey, I'm going to be the cool caste. Y'all are the messed up caste. And all of my children are now in the good caste, and all their children are not. Foreigners, we don't know what to make of them. One of the interesting effects of this, and this is another highlight of the importance of a worldview, the consequences of your worldview. Christians in India, many, many Christians, many Muslims still follow caste systems. I had a Christian friend in college. He said he was a Brahmin. That's the priestly caste. He knew that. Why? What use is it? It's important. Some Christians will only marry other Brahmin Christians. They will only, some of them even separate churches by it.
That's just a classic, I mean, for us, an unusual, but a classic illustration of how culture has so much effect, even your Christian beliefs, and how careful we have to be to pull ourselves out of pagan thought and try to, as much as possible, be as pure as we can, you know, relative to the scripture.
Right.
Because I'm sure a lot of these folks, they don't even see that.
Right.
They just, that's just the way culture is, and so they find a way to integrate it with Christianity.
One interesting pastime, if you're ever curious, there are matrimonial websites for Indians, Indians in America, Indians in India. Basically, it's a personals type thing, except it's for parents. So the parents will say, "I want a Brahmin, this old, this education level, this salary." Same thing for the Christians. You go Hindu, Muslim, and then you go to the Christian section. It says, "I want a Jacobite Christian." I want a Roman Catholic Christian. I want a Syrian Christian. And it's treated in very much the same way as the caste system. What you're born is who you are. Whether you're converted or not, there's no notion of that for a lot of them. There are many Christian believers, but even they are affected by this thinking.
Jimmy, smattering of questions here. Hmm. What do Sikhs believe? Indians wear a turban, and what's the significance of the god on the forehead?
Well, we will be covering Hinduism later in the class, but Sikhs are, I believe, monotheistic, and they believe some sort of god, and the violence thing, you see a turban, there's a knife probably under their jacket, is a religiously justified result of having been persecuted by Hindus for a long time. The turban is because to keep their hair up. They don't ever cut their hair, sort of a Samson type thing. I don't really know the why exactly. I can look it up for you if you'd like. The bindi dot on their forehead symbolizes the third eye, that by which you see Brahman, the ultimate reality. Now, who wears it? Depends on where you are in India. In Gujarat, which is western India, north of Bombay, some of the men will wear two lines and a dot. Those are the men. in southeastern India, some of the men will wear a mark on their forehead during certain times of year, a different color. Northern India, a red dot is for women, signifying they're married. Widows wear a different color. It symbolizes the third eye, the eye with which you see past the illusion. That's really all I wanted to cover. Scott will be starting on, I guess, epistemology next. And you look back at all these non-Christian worldviews, and as I've said, it highlights just how far man will go to suppress the truth, to suppress the knowledge of God. And it also highlights... yes, Shelley.
The Indian Hindu woman in Atlanta told her father would die. The way she described that is, he is no more. Is the belief in reincarnation universal? I mean, do they believe it always happens? And do people outside of Hinduism get reincarnated?
They get everybody who has a soul. There's a notion of soul, and that's what lasts through reincarnation. If you die, then your soul will take on a new body. I don't know what she meant by, and I have to admit, I'm no expert on Hinduism. I don't know what she meant by he is no more. She might have meant he was a really good Hindu and so he's free now. She might have meant his body is no more. What I knew of him, he's somewhere else, completely unknown to me. He is no longer on the particular karmic road that he was on. But I don't know.
When I asked what determines it, I was thinking in terms of reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Is there a God or is this...
Karma. Karma is a... And is karma different from not karma? You know, or is that illusion? Karma is what determines where you go next, up or down. Karma is determined by... how good you are in life. There is a book, and I don't remember who it was written by, but it describes the conversion of this very, very devout Hindu to Christianity, and he discusses the way Hinduism is in everyday life, and one of the aspects was that a beggar came to his house and asked for food, and he gave him food because that would increase your karma. The beggar... knew that that would increase his karma, and so he said he was not very grateful. He demanded everything. He was very rude, demanded medical assistance and all kinds of things, and then the guy gave it to him because he knew that it would increase his karma. To do otherwise would be to decrease your karma. Karma is almost like fate, but it is very much determined by what you do in life, so it's not quite like fate. It's not hard set, but if something bad happens to you, there's probably a reason why. And it's probably because you're low on karma points. You know. So that's what affects where you end up in your next life. Okay. Scott?
Thank you very much, Jimmy. That was very interesting. I'm wondering if Calvin Klein has come up with a stylish dot yet for some Hindus in certain worldly...
Some of them are paint. Stickers. And some of them are very elaborate.
I've heard too that sometimes when you're talking with a Hindu and you present an argument, a logical argument, sometimes you'll get stuck with the rebuttal that, well, you're using Western logic on me and that doesn't apply. And it just shows you how that even something as certain as what we as Westerners and as Christians would think, as something as certain as logic, is not accepted by people who have a monistic worldview that says that there are no distinctions, and the idea of syllogisms and all that implies distinctions and that kind of thing. Am I right in saying that?
That's right. And you can even say, and this is another thing that Boston did, said in discussing with a Hindu, you can say, oh, you don't use logic, do you? Well, you do then. Because you're not restricted from contradicting yourself. And so, that's games you can play, but they certainly illustrate the silliness of the world.
All right. Well, Jimmy has has concluded the first main bullet point of fleshing out a Christian worldview, and that is what is real or what is ultimate reality. And as I think he's clearly illustrated, not everybody's in agreement on this issue. You can't just walk out, as it were, onto your front porch and determine what ultimate reality is, right? It's very much determined by ultimate faith commitments. And the idea of ultimate faith commitments is not a bad thing, because that's exactly what we have as Christians. And those ultimate commitments or ultimate basic assumptions about the nature of reality, the nature of knowledge, which we'll talk about today and also next week, and the nature of ethics, is the worldview grid that we opened with in our class. All right? Anybody else want to wear these in front of the class to illustrate the point again? The fact is, when you put these glasses on, everything looks pink. And that illustrates the idea that you have assumptions about the nature of what's real, what and how we know things, and ethics that colors the way you look upon the facts. Okay? So we're going to move now into the second main point. And in my thinking, this is the most... I hope that I can communicate some of this stuff all right, because it can get to be a little bit difficult, but on the other hand, it's very fundamental to how we as Christians defend the truth and defend Christianity. The technical philosophical word that's used for this is epistemology. Philosophy tends to look at reality in terms of metaphysics, or what is ultimate reality. Epistemology, what do we know and how do we know? And then ethics, and I think that one is obvious. Are there such things as moral absolutes? What is the good? What is evil? Is there good and evil? That kind of thing. Now, you may remember, too, and Jimmy brought this up, that all three, and I'm just simply saying this by way of redundancy, so we don't get stuck looking at these as three individual, separated kind of ways of looking at reality. But just like when you go to a doctor's office and you look through this lens, and he says, can you see the letter B in there? Yeah, I can. All right. Then they move this lens over and say, is it clearer or is it fuzzier? They say, it's clearer. Then they move the next lens over. Oh, now it's real clear. All right. This represents what is ultimate reality? What do we know and how do we know? And what are ethics? And all three of these are merged together. That produces the lenses for a Christian worldview. So today, we're going to look at this lens here. What and how do we know? Now, you may remember that this is not an issue that is... There's no consensus in philosophy about this issue. Unbelievers, atheists, or pagans, or theists, or polytheists, all of these different kinds of unbelievers, have problems and arguments with one another. Even within science, there are discussions about these kinds of issues. What do we really know? How do we know? This asks the question, what counts as true knowledge, and how do we know? And for the sake of defining knowledge in this class, what we're going to say is this. What is knowledge? Knowledge equals justified, and I put this in parentheses because I think it's obvious, justified true belief. That's what we as Christians believe knowledge is. Knowledge is justified belief or true belief. All right? Let me explain that a little bit farther. Okay. Here you have a little girl, and she has been told that Santa Claus exists. So she has a belief. The belief is Santa Claus exists. Is that belief knowledge in our definition of knowledge? It's not. Why isn't it? It's not true. It's not justified true belief, right? Now, in her world, she might have warrant for believing it because she trusts her parent. Right? So there's a sense in which it's justified in terms of the purview of her dependency upon her parents. Okay? But in the ultimate scheme of things, it's not at all true belief, even though she's warranted in believing it as a child. You Follow me on that? So we're talking about knowledge being justified true belief, not merely beliefs. What's interesting is that the world tends to look at things like this. They say you've got facts, that is knowledge, and then over here you have beliefs, and that's where religion falls in. That kind of thing, that dichotomy, is something that we are confronted with all the time. At the work, within science, they'll say, yeah, all right, it's okay. If you want to believe God exists, that's fine. That's in the realm of belief. But for the sake of science, we're going to stick to the realm of fact, what we can prove by our senses, that kind of thing. This has probably no relationship to this, but if you want to have your own subjective fancy about God and heaven and angels and all that kind of thing, that's fine. And these days, what's really interesting is that this realm of fact is starting, seems to get shrinking smaller and smaller, and a lot more things are getting put into this realm of mere belief, which is not necessarily factual. And morals are another example. They'll talk about, you know, at work, if you're in a real politically correct straitjacket work situation, morals are simply values. And values are in this realm and not in the realm of fact. Okay? Or they'll talk about postmodernists now is actually talking about most things being in this realm. Or if not almost everything is in this realm now. They say that, you know, you can't even trust science anymore because of all the biases we bring to it, and ultimately science itself becomes an extension of one man's attempt to suppress another person. And so basically everything starts to migrate over into this realm. And in fact, that's what happens when you reject God. Because when you reject God, you start throwing out absolutes. And at first it just seems, oh, okay, we can live in this world, the realm of the factual, and relegate God to this realm, the realm of just belief. But once you do that, you start finding that the whole worldview starts to crumble over time. Suddenly, you know, they don't have a ground for moral absolutes, so that goes into the realm of belief. Then there's no ground really for rationality itself, and that goes into the realm of mere belief rather than the realm of fact. You follow me on that? So what we're going to do is talk about knowledge as justified true belief. And in beginning that, we're going to talk about the futility of autonomous reasoning. The futility of autonomous reasoning. All right, what do I mean by autonomous? How would you define autonomous? That's go ahead.
Something that stands alone.
Something that stands alone. Now, if we say that, an unbeliever is committed to autonomous reasoning, based on everything you know about this class, what do you think we're saying there? That's right. That I am my ultimate standard. Or a group of experts is the ultimate standard for me. Right? It's self-governing reasoning rather than reason that is dependent upon God, dependent upon revelation. You see the difference? Maybe it will become clearer as we move along here. I'm going to draw a triangle. You're going to see this triangle crop up a lot, all right? Because it's going to come also into our discussion about ethics. Here's the triangle. Probably should make it a little bit lower so I can write up at the top there. All right, non-Christians, and we discussed this briefly, or in the realm of philosophy, there are basically three tendencies towards which people's epistemological commitments migrate. In other words, when they talk about how they're trying to assess what is knowledge, how do you justify beliefs, what can we know, what can really be known, they tend to polarize in one of these three directions, although no person's philosophy is only in one of these three directions. They just tend to have more of a tendency towards one than the other. First one up here is rationalism. You remember this? Rationalism. Down here would be empiricism. I don't know if I got the I wrong there. And then over here would be subjectivism. Now, this is going to be easy to understand once I flesh it out. All right, first of all, rationalism. People who have a more rationalistic bent towards gaining knowledge. They say, you know what, we believe that there has to be some kind of knowledge that we have as humans that is independent of experience. In other words, the things we know are not based upon what we touch, taste, feel, hear, whatever, but rather they are a priori. They are known to be true before experienced. And that serves as criteria by which we evaluate our experiences, our empirical observations of the world. All right? Rationalists will say things, for example, like the laws of logic or math, laws of math, abstractions, things like that, that we know these things before they're experienced. And I'll give you an example. All right? Here, I've drawn a circle. Is that a perfect circle? It's not. Have you ever seen a perfect circle? You've seen a perfect circle. Well, then how do you know what a perfect circle looks like? Do you know that, I mean, how do you know what is a perfect circle unless you have seen it? You say, well, I just know it. I know that that's not perfect. That Well, then you have knowledge of an abstraction. Is it real knowledge? If it's not, then you don't know what a perfect circle is. If it is real knowledge, then it's an abstraction that really exists. And you know that that's not a perfect circle. These people say that things like abstractions, now again, there are differences, and I'm really generalizing when I talk about rationalists, because rationalists will limit or allow for more criteria depending upon the individual philosophy. But they say you have these a priori or before experience knowledge that help you to interpret your empirical observations. That's one tendency, rationalism. Plato would be an example of this. All right, empiricism. And these days, in the 21st century, 21st century, philosophers have tended to migrate away from rationalism because it tends to seem more mysterious. How do we get a priori ideas about a world before we experience them? That doesn't make sense. That sounds kind of religious. So they tend to migrate towards empiricism. And you've heard about the, have you ever heard the statement, the tabula rasa? Hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. John Locke, I think, was the first one to advance that. Basically, we're born and our mind is like an empty slate. And everything that we know is etched upon that slate through our five senses. There are no a priori, there is no a priori knowledge that we have about the world through which we interpret the world. It's just a blank and empty slate, and everything we experience etches knowledge upon that plate. That's empiricism. Knowledge is only known through the five senses, or through the five senses, and through instruments that we create in order to give us knowledge. And the instruments themselves are created by our senses. All right. Then the third tendency is subjectivism. Subjectivism says, you know what? I understand what you're saying about rationalism, about how we have a need for criteria. I understand how you're saying that we experience things in the world, but ultimately everything that we experience comes through the grid of our own biases and assumptions about reality and things like that. And ultimately, when I look at my Clark, I mean, it's not like my brain is touching Mike. I haven't taken my brain out of my head and it's touching Mike. I'm seeing Mike, but that's being converted into electrochemical impulses, which then are going to my brain and are being interpreted. So really what I'm knowing is not Mike in and of himself. I'm knowing my own thoughts about Mike. I'm knowing my own inside world, the world that's inside, not necessarily and directly the world that's outside my own head. You follow me on that? So they say that knowledge really is very subjective. And our minds add all kinds of categories. We bring our own biases into the equation, our own interpretations, stuff like that. Ultimately, we come down to skepticism. All that I really know are my own thoughts. And I can experience things, but that goes through the grid. I can put up criteria. But again, it's all very subjective, and it's only what goes on in my mind. These are three tendencies of philosophy. Now, one thing that all three of these are in agreement on is this. All three of these general tendencies are committed to one principle that they share in common, and that is this: autonomous reasoning. They are committed in some way or another to believing that they are the standard of what they can know. They're not dependent upon God's revelation. They're dependent upon their own philosophical, rational, epistemological schemes, right? Rationalism, empiricism, and subjectivism. Now, does that mean that everything about rationalism is bad? No, because as Christians, we have a rationalistic aspect to us. We believe that there are criteria that God has given to us, even before we've experienced it, that help us to interpret the facts of our experience. But we'll talk about that later as we go through this. Is there anything, is empiricism totally wrong? Is everything about empiricism wrong? No. I see Mike, I believe he exists, and I believe that gives me real knowledge of Mike. Okay? But I'm also interpreting it according to a Christian criteria, and we'll talk about that later. Subjectivism. Is it true that ultimately I'm knowing my own thoughts? Yes. But the wonderful thing about Christianity is that we believe that God has oriented our minds to correspond to the environment in which He's created us, so that when I know my own thoughts, I am knowing reality. There is a connection between what's out there and what's here. Now, you've heard of the illustration. You have three blind men, and there's a big elephant standing here in the room. You heard this illustration before. The Hindus like to use it. The postmodernists like to use it. And, you have one blind man, and he has a hold of the elephant's trunk. All right. Then you have the other blind man, and he's holding on to the elephant's leg. And then over here on the other end of the elephant, and I'd rather be on the first end, but he's holding the tail. All right. And you ask this man, you say, "What is it that you have? What is it you have?" And he feels it, and he says, "I've got a hold of a giant rope that's very strong, and somebody's tugging on the end of it." All right. Then you come to the middle guy, and you say, "What is it that you got a hold of?" And he says, "I have a hold of a tree trunk, and boy, is it strong and sturdy." Then you go to the first guy, and you say, "What is it that you have a hold of?" And he says, "I don't know." He goes, I'm glad I can't see it, but I think I got a hold of a big snake. You know, it has a lot of muscle in it, and it's moving around. And then if you could suddenly give them their sight, they would see that the connection between their limited experience of the elephant relative to the whole elephant yielded them very poor knowledge of the whole thing, right? That is a great illustration of where non-Christian epistemology goes. When you are committed to the idea that you only have some kind of a limited sliver of knowledge on the elephant, and that you deduce and infer everything based upon that narrow experience of the elephant, or certain rational principles that you assume beforehand, which really may not give you knowledge of the real elephant, because you... Well, I'll go a different direction on that one. Yes?
Isn't that exactly what Carl Sagan would say about evolution, using that same argument?
Could you elaborate more? Because I don't know much about him.
He would argue against everybody else who had a contrary point of view by saying that you could only see a smattering of the facts and you didn't have enough information.
So what would that be? What is he arguing in favor of then?
He's saying that evolution is most likely true.
Yeah, it really is.
But he would say that it's obviously true because you don't have enough information to prove otherwise.
Well, actually, believe it or not, it's in my notes here, and I've already emailed it to you if you didn't get it. One of the finest philosophers in the world today is Alvin Plantinga, who is also a professing Christian. And he has produced a paper called The Evolutionary Argument Against Naturalism. Basically, what he argues is this, and this shows how metaphysics, what Jimmy just talked about, our theory of what's real, correlates very much with what we can know and how we know. Basically, what he argues is this. Now, in evolution, in total evolutionary science, what you have is this, right? You have an organism that's in an environment. The environment is hostile to the organism. But that organism has genes that can mutate. And as those genes mutate, And as nature selects the genes that are most fit for the environment, the organism develops and evolves. And it takes, you know, great lengths of time until eventually you have very complex, well-adapted organisms to their environment, right? Well, then that means that's the way that our cognitive abilities have developed too. Our cognitive abilities, according to evolution, have evolved to reinforce survival, not necessarily to give us true knowledge of the world. So Alvin Plantinga, and it's a very sophisticated paper, and most of you, you'll start reading it, and you're going to say, I'm not even going to finish this, all right? But it's something good that you can email to a friend who has this kind of Carl Sagan-ish view of things, and that is that if you believe that evolution produced our cognitive faculties, then it's very likely the case that you don't have true knowledge of the world. You only have knowledge that reinforces survival, and that may or may not be true, true knowledge of the world. Consequently, evolution becomes a defeater for your belief in naturalism because you don't even know for sure if the argument that you're using conforms real knowledge or not, but rather just a survival mechanism. So did that make sense the way I explained that? So? Well, to look at it from a different way, we could say it this way. When God created man, and we'll look at this more in the next class period, when God made us, he put us in a garden, he created the environment, the Garden of Eden, and he formed our minds so that it corresponds with the environment and can yield true beliefs about it. Whereas evolution says, all of this chance, time, chance, and natural selection has produced organisms that are fitted for survival rather than necessarily for having true knowledge of the world. Maybe that some of the knowledge that we act upon as evolved beings is true and some of it is not true. But it doesn't matter because we have been honed by our genes to believe that which helps us to survive rather than what is necessarily true or false. You follow me? So if you believe in evolution, you're probably not going to have a good reason to believe that you have any true knowledge of the world that you can be certain about. You follow me on that now? Hope that made it a little bit more clear. But we'll go into this a little bit farther next class period. The bottom line is this. Non-believing views of what is real and how do we know is riddled with serious problems. And it eventually either goes in the direction of skepticism or in the direction of I can know all things, and then they realize they can't, and then it goes to skepticism. All right? So let's go ahead and conclude in prayer, and we'll pick this up next class period. Heavenly Father, we thank you very much for your mercies and your kindnesses to us. We thank you that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and that the knowledge of the holy is understanding. We thank you that you made us. We thank you that you made our minds to know truth, to know our world. We thank you that you are the beginning and the middle and the end of all that that we need to live in this world well. We pray now that you would prepare us for worship together and that you would bless those who bring the Word of God to us. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.